We might as well just get this going here. The first speaker is going to be Mike Manwaring. We're just going to go down order. I don't know if everybody's sitting in order, but you'll see as they come up who they are. Mike works for HDR, and he's going to give a presentation on why aren't we building new grid-scale energy storage projects. Mike.
All righty. Thanks, Ross. Again, my name is Mike Manwaring with HDR Engineering. I'm out of Charlotte, North Carolina. I spent the last 10 years in California and Sacramento working on energy storage projects, and that's a bit of the focus of my talk today. In my side job, I chair the National Hydropower Association's Pump Storage Development Council, which is trying to help various project developers and utilities looking at new projects. So here's a little bit about my presentation agenda, kind of introducing pump storage projects or bulk storage projects, which for this talk today is really focusing on pump storage and compressed air, talking a little bit about why they're being built elsewhere in the world and not necessarily here in the United States, some of the development challenges we were faced here in the United States, specifically regulatory, legislative, and financial challenges, some thoughts about what can be done to help these projects get developed, and then a little bit on future opportunities. Good thing about going the afternoon of the last day of presentations is folks have probably seen graphs like this. This is put out by ESA. So what do I mean by my bulk energy storage? This is a graph that's looking at rated power versus discharge time. It's a log-log scale. So what I'm referring to when I say bulk storage are these two technologies. So this is on a linear scale. So it's really compressed air and pumped hydro. Battery projects are getting large enough that they're part of certainly the bulk discussion as well. Where does the line fall between bulk and distributed energy storage? I think it's really an irrelevant question. They're all tools in the toolbox for managing our energy grid. So a little bit of history about what pump storage is. I'm kind of the lone wolf describing pump storage here at this conference. You have an upper and lower reservoir. Upper, lower, you've got an underground cavern. Typically, some are surface caverns, but typically they're underground. When you're generating water down from the upper reservoir through the turbines into the lower reservoir, again, the process is reversed during times of excess energy, low-cost energy, when you're trying to recharge the upper reservoir. Some of the new changes that I'll be discussing a little bit in the presentation today are what's going on around the world with new energy store or new pump storage technologies from an equipment standpoint. How new projects are being designed to respond very fast. And when I say very fast, it's 50 megawatts a second or so, which is probably the fastest plant in Norway, which is in Wales. So where are current pump storage projects in the United States? This is a map where the 40 projects exist, representing about 20,000 megawatts, about 2% of the U.S. capacity. Pump storage projects started... were first developed in the 1920s in Europe, in the 1930s here in the United States. But most of the pump storage projects we have in the United States were associated with a nuclear build-out. If you drew a 100-mile radius around the average nuke plant in the United States, you'd probably hit a pump storage project or vice versa. Just as a side note, there's a project about 30 miles here from here recently just being commissioned now by the San Diego County Water Authority. It's a Lake Hodges Liebenheim project. It's a 40-megawatt pump storage project that was built as part of an emergency water supply system. They were already going to be pumping uphill to store water as part of the emergency water supply, and they decided to put in units that can generate as the water's coming down. So just a quick snapshot of where projects are in the world. There's about 127,000 megawatts worldwide. The majority of them are in Europe, Japan, China, and then North America. That's the four bars over there. Again, it's about 20,000 megawatts in the United States. The two projects listed, one is the Bad Creek Chokasie project on the top that's owned by Duke Energy in North Carolina, and this is the Goldestal project in Germany. One of the slides I just added was this one. Folks saw this graph, and I had two or three people ask me about this one. This is the Okinawa Yambura Seawater Project in Japan. That's not a natural reservoir shape up on the top of the hill, but it uses it's the Philippine Sea is the lower reservoir there. It's a 30-megawatt project that was developed in 1999 and is still being utilized today. So a little bit about why is pump storage project being developed around the world. In Europe, significant build-out, again, similar to the United States, because of wind and solar development. One of the challenges that Europe faces that they're looking to big bulk pump storage is the lack of access to natural gas for their fast response and regulation. And areas in Europe do have some established markets and tariff structures for the revenues. One of the things that I'll talk about a little bit are the challenges facing big bulk pump storage projects getting developed here in the United States is it's tough to finance a billion-dollar project on day-ahead or spot markets. China's building significant quantities of pump storage. They're building a lot of energy projects, period, but they're mostly being built by the transmission companies, similar to one they were built here through vertically integrated utilities back in the nuclear build-out. Japan has a long history of really technology advancements, and they've been building pump storage partly from a national sponsorship, but because they're an island system, they must maintain their grid reliability. We look at just kind of global installed wind capacity. Different reports will say different things, but I think I pulled this data from IEA or EIA, which is about 18 gigawatts of wind in 2000, turned about 121 gigawatts in 2008. I think 2010 was about 145 gigawatts globally. So some examples of the tariff structures that are favorable for bulk energy storage projects being developed worldwide. Germany has a no transmission interconnection fee for storage, which can be pretty significant. I know one project here in the U.S. was going to get hit with about $600 million of a transmission upgrade, so it's not a small savings. And then Portugal is another example. They if you increase the capacity of renewables, you're able to lengthen the term of your license, which in the United States here is similar to, say, a FERC license, which can be anywhere from 30 to 50 years. If you in Portugal, if you're able to increase the capacity of a project, you get a longer term than without one. So again, just another quick snapshot. These two graphs here are borrowed from the EIA report I mentioned before. The eye chart graph on the right is it's a table showing where natural gas reserves are in the United States or around the world, starting from the largest percentage. It's Russia, Iraq, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, United States, and on down of the first nine. About 60% or so, I think, are captured that market. And one of the issues with natural gas globally that's causing this development is certainly in Europe is the concern over access to natural gas. It's not quite the same here in the United States where we have abundant supplies, where that's our certainly from an energy storage technology, that's one of the things that has to be considered as an alternative. While natural gas plants can't do decking reserves, they can do most of what a large bulk storage project can do. The graph on the left, again, is another snapshot of projected wind growth through 2035, looking at about a 300% growth of wind, and that's just in the United States. So where are pump storage projects being constructed? Kind of by region, the table on the left, looking at Europe, putting in about 5,200 megawatts. Asia, excluding China and India, about 4,200. China itself is about 3,500 megawatts, and so on. You can read that, but the other thing is you don't really see the United States on here except for the 140-megawatt project that I mentioned here in San Diego. another rather hard to read graph, but the only point of this graph, this map here, is if you remember the previous graph, previous map of where pump storage projects are, they're predominantly in the east, and this is just here to show that the interest in pumped hydro is certainly in the west. In California, there's 12 or 13 projects, and what this map shows are those that have filed preliminary permits with FERC. It's the initial step to try to develop a project in California. There's 12 or 13 preliminary permits that have been granted by FERC for development, representing somewhere between 7 and 10,000 megawatts of those projects. Two, three, you know, maybe developed. So I'm not going to get into too much of the ancillary services. Folks have talked about this. I think one of the earlier presenters talked about up to 17 different ancillary services. When pumped hydro was originally developed, it was more towards load shifting or energy arbitrage, the buy low, sell high. And now markets for pump storage projects in the United States are looking at taking into advantage of ancillary services, similar to what most other folks are. And as I mentioned, the challenge that pump storage projects are facing is trying to finance such a large project on the markets, which are really, even when they are formalized, are more spot or day ahead. This was provided to me by some of our equipment folks in the world talking about what the technical capabilities of new equipment and power electronics can do. You'll see from kind of right to left, the historic, how pump storage projects were historically operated, were on the daily cycle. It would pump up in the middle of the night when power was low, generate during the peak times. Since deregulation, one of the things that certainly that we've observed with pump storage projects is they operate a couple times a day. They take advantage of inner hour or inner day, certainly two or three times. Some projects, there's a project in Rome, Georgia, that it's not uncommon for them to pump up or generate two or three times a day. And then getting into some of the abilities with the new, whether it's adjustable speed turbines, or there's a technology called ternary units, which is a short circuit to allow the water hammer, which is one of the big issues with pump storage projects. It kind of short circuits around that. And then when you get down into the sub-second range, some of the new variable speed or ternary units, they're able to act like a, I guess, per unit, a 250 to 250 megawatt or more flywheel when it's in AGC. A little bit about compressed air. I know Bob Shaniker's group from EPRI will talk a little bit about this in the next panel, but you know, they're being looked at pretty similar to pump storage for the reasons why all bulk storage projects are being looked at. For those that aren't aware, but I think most folks are, there's two existing compressed air plants, one in Germany and one in Alabama. They've been around, I think the German one in Germany's in the 70s, and McIntosh plant in Alabama since 1991. And a lot of the interest in obviously compressed air is because of the low natural gas fuel prices. It's becoming more and more common, I think, in areas where there are well-understood subsurface conditions. And as it shows up there, Texas, Ohio, New York, Utah, certainly other areas, but those are some of the prime focus for new projects. So really to the point of my talk today, some of the major hurdles that bulk storage projects are facing, and this is really more for pump storage and other projects, one is the regulatory process. I mentioned, or I showed the map with 100 or more preliminary permits being taken out on projects in the United States. The time frame from that preliminary permit to commissioning of a plant can be anywhere from 8 to 10 years. That can be 3 to 5 years for the FERC licensing process, 3 to 5 years for construction. So that's not an insignificant amount of time for what may or may not be a project being developed. From a legislative perspective, there's issues with certainly the Avista restriction. For those that were aware of the FERC NOI that was put up a couple months ago, there was a long description about the Avista restriction and market power studies. existing markets. This is one that's becoming a pretty large focus between who has control of an asset. If it's a generation asset, FERC has authority of it. If it's a transmission asset, BAs or ISOs, and that's been discussed. And then the idea of financing, I talked enough about the day ahead versus spot market, but one thing that's on here I wanted to highlight is, I'm not sure if this was mentioned before, PG&E's rate case for pump storage studies to be put into looking at rate basing that for at least the studies was denied, and what CalISO said was the needs had not been demonstrated at this point. That's something that PG&E will probably refile on. I think the folks that are looking at refiling now that CalISO's come out and said they definitely do need storage. Sure. All right, a couple quick things. Changing regulations that will impact pump storage projects, you know, the 316B, there's the map on the right. It's basically just talking about once-through cooling plants that may get shut down. The focus of this is wind turbines and some other new generation that's coming on. It's going to miss the impact of the loss of rotating copper, rotating machines. You know, big, large turbines being taken off the grid aren't going to be replaced by smaller units, and this is really for grid stability. So this is just a quick example of a pump storage project being looked at with really environmentally benign type features. It's an old abandoned iron mine with two reservoirs that already exist. So this is kind of the latest generation of what a pump storage project would look like. And this is kind of the last thing I'll discuss. It's what's being looked at now to try to help establish markets. And we've talked to FERC about this, and this is a model off of the existing gas storage model. And it's looking at the concept of having multiple off-takers or multiple people being a part of a pump storage project. You know, the example here is a 1,000-megawatt project, and if you sold the project in 100 or 200-megawatt chunks to various interested parties to have a reservation charge in a reservoir or in a pump storage project similar to gas storage model, the idea would be to have a reservation charge, you have an injection fee, withdrawal fee similar to gas storage, and then the thing that the ISOs or the balancing areas would look at is, you know, they would have control of some portion of this. In this example, let's say it's 200 megawatts for transmission services and ancillary transmission and ancillary services. We brought this concept to FERC. They're very concerned about the idea of having a 1,000-megawatt project having significant market power, but if done right, they were very interested in this. All right, so that's really my last slide. This just talks about activities that those in the pump storage world are doing, dealing with FERC, certainly in California with the Energy Commission and CalISO. We've been participating in various actions. FERC has said, you know, bring us solutions from energy storage, and we're happy to work with you. They asked us to provide some more information on the energy storage model. And then the last comment was from CalISO last week or the week before in Seattle, that they definitely are comfortable saying they need 2,000 megawatts of storage, and it may be 3,000 to 4,000. Of course, that's what they're willing to say at a pump storage conference, and that may be different than what they say in other places. Thank you.
Talk on energy storage, a cheaper, faster, and cleaner alternative to conventional frequency regulation. Giovanni.
Good afternoon, and thank you for your time today. As we mentioned in the beginning, I'm going to talk about frequency regulation, and in particular, what I'll first talk about is a comparison between a conventional CCGT power plant to a flywheel and compare the economics that we modeled for that. And then I'll talk about some of the issues surrounding frequency regulation, what are some of the regulatory and policy issues that are going on to promote energy storage as we speak. So first, a little bit about Stratagen. We're a boutique management consulting firm providing strategic consulting advice to a wide variety of clients that range from all the way from down to very small early startups to large Fortune 500 companies looking to diversify into clean energy. So in 2009, Stratagen and others founded the California Energy Storage Alliance, or CESA, and the point of CESA is to promote or advocate energy storage in the state of California and also at FERC. As you can see, we have about 38 members currently, and that's growing every day, and it's a very diverse set of advocates that we have in the energy storage market, from technology players, big and small, to developers and also renewable energy providers such as PV and wind. So why do we focus on California today? For the first reason is California is a big market, and we're in California today, here in sunny San Diego, although it's foggy today. Another thing is that a lot is going on in California on the regulatory front and the policy front. There's a landmark legislation called AB 2514, which calls for the CPUC to launch in a proceeding to actually focus on energy storage and potentially set procurement targets for energy storage in the state of California. There's also the 33% RPS. There's specific incentives in California for energy storage. There's a self-generation incentive program, which is $2 per watt. And then there's other things happening in California, such as the CAISO focusing specifically on energy storage now. There's all the other agencies, the CPUCs I already mentioned, CAISO, CARB, which is the California Air Resources Board, and the California Energy Commission are all interested in storage and pro-storage. And there's also a program at the CAISO to focus on energy storage being integrated into their market. And you've probably, in addition, have heard from several people at this conference and other storage conferences that many demonstration projects from government grants and such are going on in the state of California. So it's a very exciting place to be for storage, and CESA is involved in all of these, as well as Stratagen. So now to get into our analysis of comparing a CCGT to a flywheel. First of all, Stratagen was the project lead, and then we took our very valuable resources that we have in our CESA membership to get information from them and input on how to structure the report and also how to integrate all the information that we have. You can see there are three primary players there. Then we had to select a technology, and while CESA and Stratagen, we definitely advocate a variety of technologies for storage. We picked flywheels for this particular paper because there was a lot of field data, and there are also third-party studies that have already gone on with flywheels, so we were able to merge all that data to come up with a very solid analysis with real-life projects to work with. Then we constructed the model and to compare these two technologies, and we used data straight from the CEC, a model that they use to calculate the levelized cost of generation, and also CAISO market data to come up with what are the market prices for frequency regulation. And we also made some specific conclusions and recommendations, and I said some of them focus on, I'll talk about the financials first, and then we also, as CESA is an advocacy group for policy, I'll talk about some of the things that fell out of it policy-wise that we recommend going forward. So the general value proposition that we're talking about for flywheels and in fast energy storage in particular is that when conventional generators perform frequency regulation, they have ramping issues. The ISO has to call up to like five times as much regulation as they need just because they need it fast, but they still have this ramping issue. So if they only need 5 megawatts of ramping, they may have to call 25 megawatts to get what they need right away, whereas a flywheel and other fast energy storage devices can respond to that ISO's control signal almost instantaneously. As you can see, the comparison between left and right of the two different technologies following the control signal. So here's the punchline of the economics in this slide. So basically the flywheel, when we did this analysis, beat the CCGT in every category that we looked at. So first of all, this was a merchant play that we looked at, so a third-party merchant participating in the ISO frequency regulation market. And the IRR was 25% for the flywheel and 7% for the CCGT. As you can see, the payback was great. And also, because of the high efficiency and low fuel use that a flywheel will utilize performing frequency regulation, you can see a very vast difference between the emissions that you get for CO2. The bottom left graph is just another depiction of my previous general value proposition slide of how basically a conventional generator is partial time is fighting against the control signal and also the ramping rate, whereas the flywheel device is actually following whatever the ISO is saying almost instantaneously what they need. And if you look on the right, you can see a comparison between the performance factor. So this is what the net actual frequency regulation that the ISO gets from the device in terms of, and by net, I mean what they want minus what they didn't want, so the fighting against the ACE. And this mileage concept is really just a way to show what performance is. And you can see that in this comparison here, we have over a 3x performance factor when you compare the flywheel performance to the CCGT performance doing frequency regulation. So this is just going into some of the project details, and at the end I'll have a link to the full white paper and model, so don't try to get bogged down in looking at all the small print. But some of the main things, as I mentioned, we looked at as a merchant system, 20-year project life, and the flywheel at 87% round-trip efficiency, and also the installed costs, as you can see. This we modeled it after Beacon's flywheel system, and we took a conservative approach to their CapEx and OpEx. And we worked very closely with them in this analysis to come up with their pricing. And also the CCGT comes straight from the California Energy Commission's assumptions about what the pricing is on those. And also, as you'll see in the next slide, we didn't assume any cost of carbon, but we did do some sensitivities on that. Actually, one more thing to mention is we took a conservative approach as well, not just in the CapEx for the flywheel, but for the performance factor. We, instead of using a 3x or more, we only used a 2.5x performance factor over CCGT, so that's also another conservative assumption we used in the model. This is another slide just highlighting the various emission savings in the CalISO region, comparing coal, natural gas, and pumped hydro to flywheels and seeing what the savings is in emissions for both CO2 and NOx and SOx. As you can see, a very high percentage, almost 100%, or a 2x return or savings in emissions for CO2 and other emissions. So here is the sensitivity that I mentioned. And if we apply on the left, the dark blue graph is the IRR of the CCGT. The base case is $0 per ton for CO2 emissions. And the graph on the right, or the bar graph on the right, is $17. And you can see that because of the high efficiency and low fuel use or electricity use of the flywheel, carbon pricing hardly affects the economics at all, whereas there's a significant drop in IRR if we include a cost of carbon for the CCGT. And then the graph on the right with the line chart, That is performance factor effects. So we varied from 1x all the way up to 3x what the performance impacts would be depending on the technology. As I mentioned, we picked the one on the second graph from the right, the 2.5x, as a conservative assumption for the flywheel. And you can see how those different effects on the economics play out. So I saw I'd mentioned some things that are going on specific to frequency regulation at both the FERC and ISOs. The FERC has several rulemakings going on right now. In fact, we're anticipating a ruling tomorrow to come out, and that's the response is expected tomorrow from the FERC, and it's called RM 11-7. And we're also expecting that parties will probably file for reconsideration after that to look into the matter even further. And that's specific to compensation for pay for performance. Then I don't want to go into too many details on this, and there's several backup slides that you'll probably get. And also, just to highlight CalISO, there are there's one thing in particular called the REM, or the Regulation Energy Management, and that's going on right now as we speak at the ISO in phase one, and then they're going to be looking at rolling out phase two of a pay-for-performance compensation mechanism, as well as long-term procurement for frequency regulation. And quickly to look at some of the other ISOs, and especially I'll point out a few. So ISO New England actually already has pay for performance. And in addition, some of the others on the far, the four on the far right, those ISOs all have dispatch signal based on response time. So they dispatch their fastest response resources first, and that's an important thing as well to structure into to any market to promote energy storage. And I think, in addition to using Beacon as an, as our modeling example, I'd like to give them some support for really pushing these changes in the market and being a big proponent of opening up the frequency regulation market to energy storage. And some of the conclusions and recommendations we have, and this is kind of in particular to California because CISA in this white paper is focused on California, structuring payments to incent what you're actually injecting into the grid in terms of your product is very important. And also the implementation of the REM at the CalISO. That's in motion now, as I just mentioned a few slides ago, so that's great. That's been since we've launched this white paper that we're discussing. Also, employing the dispatch of an algorithm that selects the fastest response resource first, which some of the ISOs are already doing, and then also adopting some business practices and tariffs that pay for performance, and also long-term procurement, because long-term procurement is really the key driver to be able to finance energy storage projects in the future, so you have a steady flow of income for like a 20-year, almost like a 20-year PPA contract, such as a PV system would have. So with that, thank you very much. And
UC Davis, he's going to talk about ultra-capacitor technology for utility applications.
Okay, this is an outline of what I want to talk about. I'll make some introductory comments. Then the main part of this talk will be to show you some recent data on some very high-power ultra-capacitors and show you that the situation really has changed relative to the applicability of I think ultracapacitors to utility applications. Then I'll do that by making a comparison of ultracapacitor batteries and so forth for a particular case. Then I'll look at some pulse charging and discharging of ultracapacitors to show you that that capacitors actually can respond in a millisecond time frame. Okay, a key issue here is the power to energy ratio of the energy storage. We know that the energy is just power times time. So most of the talk is on megawatts, but when you talk about energy storage, you have to talk about both megawatt hours and megawatts. And where capacitors are great for megawatts, but not so great for megawatt hours. So that the P over E, the power to E ratio, is just one over the time of the storage. And for any technology, it's just really the watts per liter in power over the watt hours per liter of the energy storage, which has units in of one over hours. Now, for lithium batteries, high-power lithium batteries, the power-to-energy ratio is like 10 to 12. For carbon-carbon ultracapacitors, which are very high-power devices, the commercially available devices we'll see is like 200, but there are devices now that power-to-energy ratio is like 2,000. And for the newest device, which I will show you in some detail, is for hybrid ultracaps, which include carbon and ferritic, the power to energy ratio is 100 to 200. The example I want to consider is 1 megawatt hour of storage and 100 megawatts of power, which corresponds to a minimum discharge time of 36 seconds. It can obviously be a factor of 2 or 3 higher than that. Okay, this is just a list of the various applications, and the two that I think that capacitors can have some relationship to are transmission quality and regional regulation. So those, and I'm talking about maximum discharge times of 1 to 2 minutes of storage or less. Now, the ultracapacitor technologies that I'll talk about are carbon-carbon, in other words, activated carbon in both of the electrodes, and then hybrid devices that use combinations of carbon, graphitic activated carbon, graphitic carbon, or ferritic materials in combination. The standard commercially available device that people talk about is from Maxwell. All the information I'll show you were data that I actually got in my own lab. And I test them at constant current to get the capacitance and the resistance, and at constant power to get the energy density as a function of discharge time. And then from that, then I calculate out what the power capability is from the resistance, and I use the 95% efficiency for one-way discharge or charge. The capacitors are symmetric; they have the same efficiency, same resistance in both charge and discharge. And for this case, it's like 1,000 watt hours or watts per watts per kilogram. And this device has a power to energy ratio of like 200. Now we'll look at a couple of advanced devices. This comes from a company, Skelton Technology, in Estonia. It's not commercially available at the moment, but there's no reason why it couldn't be if there were money put in to develop a factory. Can see now that it's got considerably higher energy density. It's a 3.4 device rather than a 2.7 volt device. Its energy density is around 6.5 or 6.6, and its resistance is quite low. We'll see here that now the 95% power density is 3,846 3.86 kilowatts per kilogram, And a lot of times people quote the matched impedance, and you can see that this device on a matched impedance basis has 40 kilowatts per kilogram. Very high, it's a very high power device. Now we'll look at another carbon-carbon device. This is from a company, UNESCO, in the Ukraine. Again, this is a device. There's no reason why it couldn't be produced in quantity. Its energy density is about the same as the Maxwell device, a little higher, 4.6, but its power capability is extremely high. We'll see that it's almost 9 kilowatts per kilogram and almost 80 kilowatts per kilogram matched impedance. It has a power to energy ratio of like 2,000 instead of 200. So these are devices that if you wanted extremely high power, extremely high efficiency for an application, these would be ideal. Now let's look at hybrid devices. This is a commercially available device the technology was developed by Fuji in Japan, but it was commercialized by JRS, a company in the United States. And you can see that its energy density now, it varies with power, with discharge time, but it's in the range of 12 to 10 watt hours per kilogram, which is a little more than double what the carbon-carbon is. And the energy density, or the 95% power is around 1,000 watts per kilogram, about the same as the Maxwell device. So this using this technology allows you to double the energy density. Now, the device that I'm really excited about these days is a device from UNESCO, the Estonia company, and again, it's a completely packaged device. It's 2.7 volts per cell, and its energy density now for a discharge of 100 seconds is like 26 watt hours per kilogram, and even at a discharge of 24 seconds, it's 17 watt hours per kilogram, and its power, its 95% power density is 2,900 watts. So and if you look again at the matched impedance power, it's 15 kilowatts per kilogram. So this is a device that has essentially the energy density of a lead acid battery, but with about two orders of magnitude higher power than a lead acid battery. Okay, this is just a list of all of the capacitors of various types that I've tested. You can go through there and see that. Then what I wanted to do was to compare capacitors of various types with batteries of various types, and from this you can calculate the power to energy ratio of any of these devices, and you'll see that it's like what I said earlier. For batteries, it's like 10 to 12, and capacitors, it's like 200 to 2,000. There's just no comparison between the power capability of the devices. So you can use capacitors and get one-way energy efficiencies of much greater than 95%, 97, 98%. Okay, now let's just look at
an application.
Okay. Sorry about that. Again, this is the one that I had before. So this is the basis of my selection. I want 1 megawatt hour of storage and 100 megawatts of power. I think that would be a fairly attractive combination. So essentially what that means, I want one megawatt hour. That means probably less than 100 seconds of storage, 100 megawatts of power, and I want to support a 60-cycle AC. And I want to compare lead-acid batteries with lithium batteries, and I'll use the iron phosphate results, essentially the A123 the technology, carbon-carbon ultracapacitors, and then the hybrid capacitors, and I'll use the characteristics of the UNESCO device. Okay, here, and what I did is along the top, I just have these as the characteristics that came off my previous charts. As all of any time you talk about capacitors or power devices, they're almost always sized by the energy store, either by energy storage or by life considerations. But they're costed by, and that means they're costed by how much energy you have to store, not by power. And then you use the power characteristics to figure out how much power you could provide with that much energy storage. So this is this column here is the volume of the devices. And remember, all these numbers are just on the devices. I made no attempt to look at the systems, partly because I don't have enough knowledge or information to even attempt to do that. So this is just the devices themselves. So this is how big the device would be, and you can see that the lead-acid batteries are like 15,000 liters. The lithium batteries are much smaller. The carbon-carbon capacitors, the old-style capacitors, are just way too large, but now the size of the hybrid capacitors is not much different than the size of the lead-acid batteries, which people have learned to live with. Then using the power characteristics, I can calculate then what the maximum power could be. I can obviously get lower power and more time, but you can see that with the lead-acid batteries, it's only like 3 megawatts. With the lithium batteries, it's only like 7 megawatts. It's a ridiculously high number if you use the advanced carbon-carbon devices. Now with the hybrid devices, it's 110 kilowatts, which is close to my goal of 110 megawatts, and it's close to my goal of 100 megawatts, and that would be giving me 33 seconds, or if I wanted lower power, 37. That says kilowatts. It should be megawatts. That's wrong. And 37 megawatts would be 100 seconds. Now, from a cost basis, if I say, okay, that I use the dollars per kilowatt hours, and you can see that the lead acid batteries, as you would expect, are the cheapest. Okay, I'm just about done. The lead acid batteries are the cheapest. The lithium batteries are like 700. 700. The capacitors, the carbon-carbon capacitors, are ridiculously expensive. But again, the hybrid ultracapacitors are not that different from the lithium batteries. But now, when you look at it in terms of the dollars per megawatt, you can see the big advantage of the capacitors relative to the batteries. So if you just look at it in terms of the devices, I think with the new hybrid capacitor technologies, capacitors should be reconsidered for these applications. And I found in the previous paper something that I need to look at pretty closely. Okay, all I did here was, instead of charging the capacitor with a constant current, I now used pulses. I used 10 or 20 millisecond pulses. And what I found out was that I get exactly the same shape carbon charge and discharge curve using 10 millisecond pulses as I would get if I used the constant current. That was the 10 farad device. It's a 120 farad device. And it's the same thing happens with the hybrid devices. So if you look at the capacitors, they have the same capacitance, same resistance, whether you look at them from a constant current or whether you look at them at say 10 or 20 millisecond pulses. So I think I'm just done here. Here's the conclusions. The new prototype bulk capacitors have much higher power than the commercially available ones. The new hybrid capacitor was tested with an energy density of 48 watt-hours per liter, a 95% efficiency of 5.3 kilowatts per liter. On a power basis, dollars per megawatt carbon-carbon and hybrid capacitors are attractive compared to batteries. High energy density of the high energy density of the hybrid capacitor makes it particularly attractive for power quality utility applications. And all capacitors can be pulse charged and discharged using pulses that are very short compared to the RC time constant of the device.
Thank you. Yeah. Two people, they're going to come together. One is John Wood from Occult, and the second is going to be Peter Coppin from Cicero in Australia. They're going to be discussing ultra-battery storage technology and advanced algorithms at the megawatt scale. John?
Okay, I'd like to talk to you today about the Hampton Wind Farm project in Australia. Peter and I are doing this as a tag team because there's two parts to this project. One was to implement a very solid, simple energy storage solution and to optimize that energy storage solution to the task. The second was to utilize the energy storage solution in the most effective way, and that has been Dr. Coppin's role in this case. You see the picture on the screen here. It's actually taken at the site. It's in the Blue Mountains, Australia, and the two containers you see are ultra battery energy storage containers. It's one of a family of three projects that we're implementing at the moment. And so those three projects have a common physical platform and a common logical platform, all built on ultra battery. A number of those projects is, of course, the great project by Steve Willard at PNM that has been discussed. And there's a third of these projects going in, which is a regulation services project, 3 megawatt site on PGM being implemented at the moment. All three projects use one storage product, which is called Ultra Battery. Ultra Battery is a very important breakthrough that came out of CSIRO in Australia. It's got flavors of Australia about it, flavors of the US, and flavors of Japan. Invented in Australia, soon after it was invented, Dr. Imre Zhuk made a trip to Australia and spread the message about the importance of energy storage. And so Ultra Battery benefited from that in that it was sponsored by the Australian government. Quickly got momentum in Australia. Japan noticed. Furukawa and Nido came in with funding to develop the product through to a production level. Was then turned full circle when East Penn Manufacturing acquired Occult, which was a subsidiary of East Penn, and gained the benefit to promote this technology around the world. Sandia very early noticed an outstanding feature of the technology, which was its ability to operate in a partial state of charge, between, say, 20 and 80%, and to cycle for a very, very long time. So there was a presentation a couple of years ago by a Sandia representative, Tom Hund, who showed a 13 times out performance. And off the back of that, we were fortunate enough to be involved in a couple of Dr. Zhuk's projects, the PNM project and the Regulation Services project. So Ultra Battery, a hybrid battery and ultra capacitor device, will produce many more amp hours in its lifetime before failure when applied to a storage task. And we'll get more into the technology in a presentation coming up tomorrow. So at this particular project, we're taking a variable power, which is the wind output. We're passing it through the battery. The battery operates in a partial state of charge, and we're reducing the power ramp rate out of the wind farm by an order of magnitude. And Dr. Coppin will explain the extent of that improvement. A very, very simple system. We're like noise-cancelling headphones. The turbine puts out the noise. The battery corrects the noise. Very standard power architecture utilising a very standard battery. Basically, what we say we do is simple, and we do it well. This is the logic structure, which is common between all three projects, the project in Australia, the project at PNM, and the project on the PJM network in Pennsylvania. And when you look at that logic structure, there's a lot of detail, but to understand in its simplest context, and talking to Aresh from EPRI yesterday, this is an important message for the lead acid industry. What we're doing is running a battery management system that optimizes the use of the battery and ensures its longevity. And then we present an interface from that battery management system to the application control manager. So we say to Dr. Coppin in this case, Peter, here's your football field. You can write whatever algorithm you want to optimize the wind output, and we'll keep you in the field of play. And we can say to Steve and Brian from PNM here, and to Sandia, to Abraham at Sandia, write your algorithms for your storage moving. We'll keep you in the bounds of play, and we'll make sure that your battery lasts utility periods of time. So I'd like to pass across to Dr. Coppin, who will explain how he is utilizing this standard storage platform.
Thanks, John, the tag team. Yes, I mean, it was really quite pleasing for us. I'm a meteorologist, a renewable energy scientist by training, to have a piece of technology that you didn't have to actually worry about. We had built a lot of prototypes, and, of course, they always come with issues, and it was nice to have a box where you just issued commands, charge, discharge at a certain rate, and we could concentrate on what we were best at, and that was actually getting the treatment of the renewable energy done. And I'd just like you to take you through what we've achieved so far. What you see before you is a one day's trace from that wind turbine. We're on a single wind turbine. The blue line is the turbine output, and if you look towards the right of that single day, you'll see that it maxes out. That's the range of the turbine. So that turbine was shutting on and off all day. There were turbulent periods. There was a gust front came through. And our first attempt with a battery system was to just smooth using a very, what we call a dumb filtering system. It's actually called a proportional integral controller. It's basically a filter system with a gain. And the second, there's a set point where you try, while you're taking out high frequencies, to keep the battery about half full. And that's a fixed parameter. And you can see the result of that smoothing in the second of the bottom traces, the red line, I think it is, in this case. That's the smoothed output. And you can see with a fairly long time constant filter, you've got a delay. The results are quite pleasing. In the top traces, we have the effect on the ramp rate. The raw ramp rate from a single turbine is horrific. Of course, a large wind farm would be a little smoother than this. But you can see from the yellow trace, we're getting severe swings in power output. That's ramp rate per 5 minute, that plot. The result after smoothing is the... I can guess which colour it's turned out to be. Sort of a muddy grey colour. You can see that we've managed to successfully eliminate most of the high-frequency noise. Now, there is some residual larger ramp rates. You'll see where the turbine is hitting max in a hurry there at the right. And we felt that this was really underutilising the hardware entirely. So we let loose a bunch of mathematicians we have in the organisation from our optimisation group and said, look, stop scheduling trains for a moment and see what you can do with this particular task. So we've developed a system under their guidance where we decided that there are a whole lot of goals in this business, and they have these optimization systems which can take multiple objectives and at the same time spool in a lot of cost functions while observing a lot of physical constraints. So what we've done is developed a system where we're able to optimize the operation of the storage system against multiple goals and with multiple constraints. Now, I've written this down so I don't do them an injustice. It's a quantum particle swarm optimizer. Now, I'm told that that's fairly standard fare, but to me it was a very impressive name. But the main point is it's able to deal with highly non-linear objective functions. Now, for the case of renewable smoothing, and the aim of wind power is really the primary goal is ramp rate control, because locally this is a huge issue. We're already seeing wind curtailed in our country. I noticed a talk here that was also being curtailed. A lot of the reason in our country is because the severe ramp rates from large wind farms, which we often see at 1 and 200 megawatt level, are causing a drought on spinning reserve. There's not enough to match the severe ramp rates. So objective number one is ramp rate reduction. Of course, there's a cost in all this, and the cost functions, if you read that either now or later, battery work, the cost of the hardware, how much storage you need, what's the size of the power system you're going to need for that task, plus a lot of electrical limitations on the local grid system and also physical constraints within the device, maximum rates of change of controllers and so on. They are able to throw all that into the mixer. And they use an offline training system where you take as much historical data as you can and put it through this this blender. And you come out with a system which can be run in real time. Now, to make it really understandable to a controller, and we use for our first generation systems, we use a thing called LabVIEW. This proportional integral controller has, as I said, just two fixed parameters. We decided, well, let's get these guys to actually change those two parameters in real time. So the way they this first attempt is to actually change the PI control parameters every second. So we're able to change the gain and the set point of that filter continuously to match the conditions. Thanks. That gave us another idea. Now, my background, I've done a lot of wind forecasting work, and there are a lot of statistical techniques in short-range wind forecasting techniques I thought would be able to spool into this. So what they've also incorporated into this is some of the look-ahead techniques we use in wind forecasting. Because wind has momentum, the turbine has momentum, you can utilise that to actually predict which way the wind's heading. And they're able to do that in the system as well. So I'd like you to show you the first results from this system. And for this particular example, we only have two things. We have a ramp rate goal, do as much ramp rate as reduction as you can, don't worry about the battery for the moment, and we'll introduce a little forecasting, and I'll show you some results. The left panel is the fixed parameter controller, and what we see there is a few hours of wind production on a fairly gusty day. The resultant smooth output is the yellow line, and the 5-minute ramp rate is green. I think it tends to get submerged there. On the right, we have the optimized controller, also doing a good job of smoothing out that control. But you notice a couple of things. One is the ability to shift the set point in real time has enabled this controller to lower the set point of the battery, in other words, let it drain a bit in anticipation of the wind coming up. So that's point one. It was able to drop the set point from 50 to 40% in anticipation. So there's a bit more capacity to work with. Second point, it actually reduces the 5-minute ramp rate. That is, the green line is reduced. It was able to work more efficiently than the fixed controller. And thirdly, the at this stage we're only using a short look-ahead time in the forecasting, but it's able to reduce the noise, the high-frequency noise in the system. This is because there's a lot of delays through data acquisition, command response for inverters have a time constant. And if you can look ahead and anticipate which way the wind's heading, up or down, then you can anticipate and overcome a lot of those delays through the control loop. So essentially, I won't go into the detail, but there's some ramp rate metrics. We were able to, going from fixed to optimised controller, we were able to reduce the violations of this ramp rate threshold by 50%, while on average treating the battery in the same way. There was no more work on the battery. So we're able to get a 50% increase in work out of that battery for the same capacity use. So that's where we're heading. We're building this optimised system, which can, and we're now moving to a system where we're introducing more goals. The next cab off the rank is to be kind to the battery. And we're already getting some preliminary results that we can, in addition, be kind to the battery, do more work, and with the same amount of hardware. And again, we hope to move this system eventually to solar and other applications. Thank you.
Thank you. Minutes or so, 8 minutes for questions. So maybe we could take a few and try and keep them short so more people will have a chance to ask and get some answers. Any questions? Yes, Mr. Iyer down here.
Yeah. Okay. Kind of an observation quickly and a question to Mr. Manwaring. Let's see, the siting, you alluded to this. I think there's a misperception that there's no good sites out there. We don't have to use existing waterways and bodies of water, and that's where the problem is. I think you would agree. And then secondly, the chart you showed with all the different plants, can you tell me the breakdown between merchant and utility-owned on those?
The proposed plants or the existing plants?
Proposed.
Proposed would be maybe 10%. The vast majority of those being looked at now are private development. Those certainly constant discussions with existing utilities about being the off-taker for those projects, though. But I agree with your comment about the virtually all new pump storage projects being looked at, they're not really proposing new dams on existing waterways. That's kind of the one of the developmental advantages right now.
Okay, thank you. We have we had another question that was up in front. Yes. Oh, well, I'm not sure who was for. If you've got to speak,
go for it. I've got one for Dr. Kopp. There's people have been talking to me about a thing called LIDAR, which is forecasting wind. How far ahead do you have to be able to forecast the wind to have the thing useful?
LIDAR is often used in short-range forecasting by actually pointing it ahead of the turbine. That's the sort of thing that could be useful in this case, because to overcome control loop delays and whatnot, you only need to forecast seconds. It's not tomorrow's weather. It's the next gust. So I know LIDAR is being used in pitch control mechanisms. They're investigating that in Denmark. So, yes, LIDAR, at least forward-facing LIDAR, would be quite useful in this case.
Okay, thank you.
Question for Andy Burke on the hybrid capacitors. Can you explain if there's any temperature limitation on the hybrid capacitors in terms of upper and lower temperature ranges that the capacitor will operate at? And also, can you talk to the voltage variability through discharge? You know, you're comparing the capacitors with a battery system, but the capacitor voltage obviously drops as you withdraw energy. And does that have an effect on how you would couple it into the power electronics?
Well, the first question has to do with temperatures, and that's primarily dependent on the electrolyte used. And the particular hybrid capacitors that I was testing use essentially the same electrolyte that's used in organic ultracapacitors. And for the lowest resistance, acetylnitrile is the electrolyte of choice. And it's got very good characteristics on the low end. You have to be more careful. You have to be somewhat careful on the high end. You don't want to go more than about 50 or 55 degrees C. But that's the same whether you're talking about carbon-carbon or the hybrid devices. Now the second question, which I remember, had to do with variability.
The voltage drop.
Oh, the voltage drop. Well, from that respect, the hybrid capacitor is much more advantageous because the carbon-carbon device operates between, say, 2.7 and 1.35 volts, and it's linear. Well, the hybrid capacitor only operates between 2.7 volts and effectively 2.2 volts, so it's much flatter than a carbon-carbon device. So from the point of view of mating with electronics, it's a much more advantageous characteristic.
Okay. Other questions? No? Okay. Well, let's give a final round of applause, and I think our next session starts at 2:30.